Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. The science is not settled. We have a wonderful guest today, Lawrence Solomon, a world-renowned environmentalist, author, and activist who's been at the forefront of movements to stop nuclear power expansion and to save the world's rainforests. He's a columnist with National Post and the author of many books. But the most recent, one of the bestsellers on Amazon, is called The Deniers, the world-renowned scientists who stood up against global warming, hysteria, political persecution, and fraud, and those who are too fearful to do so. He is also the executive director of Energy Probe. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lawrence Solomon to It's Rainmaking Time. Good day, sir.
Good day.
Fighting for the environment is not new to you, and it would at first appear to environmental activists that you're against saving the planet. But yet, when I read your book, I connected to being called a denier, because in my first show of It's Rainmaking Time covering climate and weather, I was called a denier for daring to ask the difficult questions and to look at different aspects of the scenario. Talk to us about why the science is not settled, having talked to all these world-renowned experts.
Well, it's not settled because there's simply no unanimity. If you canvass the views of top experts around the world, you realize that there's a dispute about whether the Arctic ice is melting in any unusual way, or if it's really business as usual. There's dispute about Antarctic melting. There's dispute about the oceans rising. There's dispute about glaciers melting. There's dispute about whether the planet is even warming. There's this dispute about the validity of the models. There's dispute, in fact, in virtually every area that the global warming doomsayers claim is beyond dispute.
Apparently, in your book, you talk about very specific rules you followed when putting the book together, trying not to settle the science yourself, which I think was very smart, and not to play the numbers game. Talk about what that means, that you didn't want to play the numbers game when you went to do your research.
Well, science isn't really about whether there's a consensus at all. Science really should be about the validity. In fact, great scientists have tended to be on the outsides of conventional thinking. They're the ones who said that the sun does not revolve around the Earth. It's the Earth that revolves around the sun. So those who break from scientific dogma have been the path breakers, and in time they've been recognized as such. So the tradition in science is not to take a vote to see who's right. The tradition in science is to pursue scientific truth. And so for that reason, the very notion of there being a consensus doesn't sit well with scientists, and I don't think it sits well with most members of the public who think about it. At the same time, the typical layman can't assess the science for himself, has to rely on the authority, on the credibility of people that he's presented with. So there is this conflict about what to do. Ultimately, we have to go with people we trust, and especially when public policy is at stake, it's necessary to have a vigorous public debate.
In the context of consensus, for just a moment, how do we arrive at a consistent frame of reference for what we're studying or talking about if consensus shouldn't be built into science? I mean, I totally get what you're saying, but then how do we even agree on anything, and should we?
Well, in most areas, I don't think we need to agree. In most areas of science, for example, some scientists can pursue paths that they think will be profitable. Others other paths that where they think that they'll be able to get valid results, and there'll be a competition among different competing theories in science, and over time that'll be sorted out, and we'll have an idea of where the truth lies.
Do you think it could be said that the more we need to have a consensus in science, that it's almost like a barometer? The more we have to have a consensus, and that's forced, the less likely true discovery can happen and be made manifest and available.
I think that's an important insight. There, in most spheres of life, we don't expect everyone to agree to be on the same bandwagon. In science, we haven't expected that in the past. But when we do expect it, when we do try to enforce a dogma on science, we do end up with untoward results, and those results it can be seen in the regular economy as well as the market of ideas.
On page 19 of your book, there was this question: what happened to the peer review process? And I was so excited when I saw this, because we're doing a show on peer review in 2 weeks. It said peer review does not fully vet the papers before they're published. Let me repeat that. Peer review does not fully vet the papers before they're published. And therefore, because peer review is seminal to, integral to, central to discovery or alternate views and hypothesis coming out into the world, then we have to look at peer review. And I just wondered if there's something that you can say about that. I thought that was an extremely important part of your book.
Well, the normal peer review process was suspended in the case of the global warming theories, and it was suspended by the IPCC. Normally, when in science, the peer reviewers are unknown to the authors of the study. That way, the peer reviewers are free to make independent comments. Under the process that the UN set up, the authors know who the peer reviewers are. So many peer reviewers would be reluctant to make a criticism of their colleagues. That's one way in which legitimate dissent was squelched. Another aspect to peer review is that when an author receives criticisms, he's expected to respond to them and to give answers for why he's accepting or rejecting them. In the process that the UN set up, that wasn't the case. The authors could really act on their own to decide what they would accept or reject. They didn't have to answer criticism. So, in effect, the United Nations process turned the peer review process on its head. The extent to which it did that was actually greater than I realized when I initially wrote my book. Only recently, with the ClimateGate emails that came out, did it become clear that often there was no not only no peer review, but not even any real science behind a lot of the claims. Often the claims were based on inadvertent comments that people might have made, or on material that might have come from a popular magazine, as was the case where the IPCC used as a source of mountain climbing magazines, and mountain climbers might comment on whether there's more or less snow that now than there was in the past, and that would suddenly make it into the IPCC report as if it had the weight of science, when it was really the views of a few hikers who were remembering things from the past.
How has your book been received beyond being an Amazon bestseller?
Well, it's been received extremely well. One thing that my foundation was surprised by was the absence of criticism from our supporters. we're a federal charity in Canada. We get support from individuals. We're one of the longest standing environmental organizations in Canada, and we expected that we would come in for a fair amount of criticism, but that really wasn't the case. The public has really, at least, sorry, the our supporters, our traditional supporters, who have been concerned in the past about the various issues that we've championed, such as conservation and renewable energy, alternate types of energy, they with rare exceptions, perhaps just three or four critics, have warmly received the views that we've presented.
Let's talk about the case of the disappearing hockey stick that Dr. Edmund Wegman, is that his last name?
Wegman.
Wegman discussed. Talk about that, because the hockey stick has been known as the poster child for the IPCC, as symbolic evidence for man-made global warming. Share that a little bit.
Well, the hockey stick graph, as you say, was the poster child for the global warming movement. The long handle of the hockey stick represents most of the last 1,000 years, during which temperatures were said to be fairly stable, and then in the last 100 years, temperatures shot up, and that's the blade of the hockey stick, and that's why the hockey stick graph got its name. So that graph is the single biggest reason that the public became swayed to the idea that the Earth is warming dangerously. The graph showed almost 1,000 years of steady temperatures, and all of a sudden, in recent times, temperatures shooting up. Well, that graph, which the UN presented with great fanfare, and the press picked up with great fanfare, became challenged. And among the critics, the chief critics actually, were a couple of Canadians. One was a Canadian statistician who worked with the mining industry. His name is Steve McIntyre, and he was actually a frustrated mathematician. He graduated from University of Toronto many years ago, had intended to take up an academic career, found himself working for a mining company, and in effect never quit the mining area. So his career was spent in mining. But when he saw the hockey stick graph, he said, "I recognize that graph. That's the graph that mining promoters use whenever they're touting a new claim." So he became suspicious of it, started looking into it, asked the authors of the graph for their data, found that they weren't forthcoming, started digging more and more, and came up with reasons to think that the graph might be bogus. Along the way, he teamed up with another academic, and together they started publishing studies discrediting the hockey stick graph. Well, this controversy ended up going to the U.S. Congress, and hearings were held, and the Congress decided to get a referee to see, well, who was right. Is it these two Canadians, or is it the UN scientists? And the person that the congressional committee got to act as referee was Edward Wegman, who was one of the top statisticians in the U.S. He's the former chairman of the Committee of Applied and Theoretical Statistics of the National Academies of Sciences. So he put together a blue chip panel to investigate the claims, and then presented it to Congress. And he was actually shocked by what he found, and not just because he found that the UN's claims were bogus. He was shocked because the UN scientists who produced the hockey stick graph had no background in advanced statistics, which was the discipline required to actually produce their study. And he was further shocked to see that the peer reviewers of the hockey stick study didn't have any real knowledge of statistics. So with no one having any knowledge in the field, it's no wonder that that graph would be invalid. Essentially, what they discovered was that the hockey stick graph, the model that produced the hockey stick graph, would always produce a hockey stick shape regardless of the data that you put into it. You could put baseball data into the hockey stick model, into that graph and into that model, and you would get a hockey stick shape.
Absolutely frightening. And yet, this graph has been seen all over the world for how many years?
Oh, it's going on 2 decades now.
Let's talk about Roger Revelle, Gore's mentor, his professor, and the influence he had on Al Gore, and what we need to know that's relevant about Roger Revelle toward the end of his life.
Well, Revelle was a legendary scientist in the field. He inspired Al Gore. Al Gore has often referred to him as his mentor. But it turns out that Revelle didn't agree that global warming was necessarily catastrophic. He thought it should be studied. He thought there was a lot that needed to be pursued. But while Al Gore was warning the world of the great dangers, Revelle was writing letters to legislators saying, "Wait a minute, look before you leap. There's no reason to assume that any kind of catastrophe is around the corner."
At the end of his life, wasn't he declared senile, or people said he was senile?
Well, it did become nasty because Al Gore, to rescue his own reputation, did promote the view that Revelle had become senile, and that became an unpleasant episode.
In the field of science, is it possible to leave your post if you've been wrong about something? Is there any wiggle room for Al Gore to be able to stand up and say, "I was wrong. I'm an environmental advocate. I want to make the world better, but I've done some things that were wrong"? Do you think that's possible?
I don't expect to hear that from Al Gore. I think it takes an unusual person to admit wrongs of the scale that his have been.
The way that I evaluate whether there's shenanigans going on in an industry or in an arena is the quicker they close the case, the faster they squelch dissent, the harder the propaganda is, and the more hysterical the matter is to talk about, the more politicized it gets, the more trouble there is in the deep levels of it. And therefore, I really would like to talk about Antarctica with you, both the Arctic and Antarctica. We have seen so many snapshots and movies and videos of ice sheets melting and polar bears standing on a little bit of ice and ready to fall in the water and no place to go. You spent quite a bit of time laying it out, but I was wondering if you could brief us. I understand that there's 14 million square kilometers of Antarctica. So when we speak of Antarctica, the part that is losing ice is in the northern peninsula. Can you talk about that? Because what we see are only little glimpses of whatever we get on videos or television or something on YouTube.
Well, Antarctica is an immense continent, and it's also an inaccessible continent. There's very little of it that has been explored. There's very little of it that provides us with measurements. We can know a little bit about the fringes, but there's only one way to know what is happening over the expanse of Antarctica, and that is with satellite measurements. So satellite measurements started to be taken a few decades ago to see if Antarctica is thickening or if it's melting, thinning. Well, what the satellite data shows is that parts of Antarctica are thickening, parts are thinning. Overall, Antarctica is thickening. So it's accumulating ice. It's not melting. It's not leading to a rising of the oceans. In fact, just the opposite. To the extent that it's thickening, it's drawing water from the oceans. So by the only measurement that really has any kind of validity, large-scale validity, Antarctica is not at all melting. It's true that in some parts there's calving that's going on. Ice is falling into the ocean, large amounts of ice, but this is part of a natural process. It's always happened. Parts of Antarctica expand, other parts recede. These days, it has been expanding.
Why are we hearing that the ice caps are melting?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's not because of the data.
Okay. And what about Greenland?
Well, Greenland has also been experiencing the great variations that we've seen. You know, Greenland was once entirely covered in ice. Then, around 1,000 years ago, there was a great warming period. It was called the medieval warm period. During that period, the Earth was probably warmer than it is today. That was a period of great flowering. It was a period when prosperity increased, lifespans increased enormously, agriculture improved. This is throughout Europe and also in Greenland. It was at that time that the Vikings settled Greenland. Agricultural colonies were set up there. It became a place that became very habitable. So the notion that the variations that we're experiencing now are anything outside human experience just doesn't correspond with the historical records.
We're going to move to the subject of the deniers itself. Anybody who's a denier is associated with what?
The term comes from Holocaust deniers, from people who denied that the Nazi Holocaust occurred. And it's a way of discrediting people who disagree with the global warming orthodoxy, to discrediting them as loons of some kind, in the same way that people who don't believe that the Nazi Holocaust occurred.
In my experience, just covering this subject, and I've done about maybe 12, this will be the 13th show, on different aspects like spokes of a wheel, there is tremendous dogma in this arena. Tremendous when you move outside of the pure data and scientific synthesis of things. It's hugely dogmatic, almost religious. I'm a person who believed in it as reality, never rolled up my sleeves to look inside the different aspects of it, was convinced and really sold from seeing an inconvenient truth and reading the book. Sold. Unchecked. I didn't verify. I just believed. And when I had the wake-up call was when I began to do an inquiry on this show, and I cover a lot of subjects on this show. I was shocked at the level of propaganda and how science has become, or maybe it's always been, we just didn't know it, how heavily politicized it is. And I'm so sad about science. And I'm wondering, do you think there's hope for science? And if so, on a funding level, what do you see for science if the popular view is this translation of what's happening on planet Earth? How are scientists going to be empowered to do their work and stay free and clear of political, I'm going to say, interference?
Well, this probably is a low point for science. I think there has always been manipulation of science and pressure and peer pressure. So a lot of what we see in the global warming science, I think on a smaller scale, has existed in the past. It does seem to me, though, to be off the charts now, the extent to which science has been politicized. But the answer to me is to remove the politicization. There's far too much funding going into the global warming science. The U.S. alone has provided something like $80 billion over the last 20 years to global warming science. The fact that there is so much money available in this area means that other areas of inquiry, of scientific inquiry, have been starved for funds. We need to scale this back dramatically, and if we do that, and also if we develop mechanisms to have funding come less from government and more from arm's length institutions, I think we will be much better off.
Why do you think it is that people that are not endorsing whatever the official story is about what's happening with climate are being forced to go along? Why do you think it is that more people don't stand up knowing that they won't be funded, but standing up to support truth and science? Do you think it's because that individuals lack internal faith that the funding may come from somewhere else?
Well, I think that there are a variety of reasons. One is that scientists aren't all scrappy. A lot of scientists they're nerds. They want to do their work. They don't really care about politics. They just want to be left alone. They might be interested in a particular pursuit, and often what they're able to do is to rewrite their funding proposal to give it a global warming slant, and then they'll get some funding for it, and they'll be able to do their work and get the results that they want. If the results aren't politically correct, they can write their conclusions in a way that hides the fact that it's not politically correct. So we get a lot of science that actually disputes the conventional wisdom, but it's written in such a way that it's just not clear. The information is fudged. So I think a lot of it just deals with the disposition of scientists. People often go into science because it's an area they love, and it's got nothing to do with public policy. It's got nothing to do with politics. It's simply a private concern. In other cases, scientists are fearful of losing funding, so they will compromise their beliefs. Scientists have families to support, and they're susceptible to the same kinds of pressure that people elsewhere are. Something else that I think has happened to science is that it has become a job. A lot of people in the past, people went into science because of a passion for science. That's no longer the case. A lot of people are choose science. They might consider a career in science or a career as a in marketing, and they might have an ability to do either, and they'll just choose the one that seems to be better paying or that might give them other perks that they're interested in. But the passion for science might not be the big driver the way it would have been, say, 50 years ago. So I think there are a lot of reasons that that scientists behave the way they do.
Do you think it's possible in my lifetime for science to be funded outside of governments?
Well, not likely, but I think that would be wonderful if it were the case. I think it would end up with a democratization of science, and we would have then more competition in the world of ideas, and I think we would have more robust results.
See, I think we need a NASA-type paradigm, and I don't mean NASA the organization, but a NASA-like occasion in business that is not run by governments and not answerable to governments, that needs to be set up to make sure that science is and will be free and clear to do its job.
One mechanism by which science can be made independent is to allow individual taxpayers to direct the research funds to any area that they choose. So if there were 300 million choosers of an area for science rather than ultimately a few government-controlled funding organizations, I think we'd see a lot of very interesting results.
I don't think we're that far from it. I think it's a question of a few people getting together and deciding that that's how it's going to be. Think about that. A lot has been done when two people agree. Let's talk about CO2. This is one of the most frightening parts of the entire debate. I grew up thinking that CO2 was a pollutant. I was taught that for years and years and years. Of course, I would never know that it wasn't, that it was food for plants and all of human life and animals and nature. But apparently, it doesn't stay in the atmosphere for 50, 100, and 200 years. Talk about it.
Well, there are lots of different different estimates of the qualities of CO2. This is another area where the science is not settled. But what you said about CO2 being nature's fertilizer is something that people really need to understand. Until not that long ago, CO2 was universally seen as beneficial, and it's really since the UN became potent in the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change started producing its reports that the view of CO2 started to change. My organization has been opposed to dirty fuels for a long time. So, for example, we have been opposed to coal because of the many pollutants inside coal. Coal has NOx and SOx and mercury. These are problems that need to be targeted, and in fact society has targeted them, and we've had very good results from the targeting. Coal has become incredibly clean over the decades. It's nothing like what it was a generation ago. Clean coal now is something that I think is desirable. But what we've started to do is to also target CO2, which is a component. The carbon is a component of coal, which is actually beneficial. It's nature's fertilizer. It helps plants grow. Until a few decades ago, we didn't have a good handle on whether the planet was becoming greener or not. And then with satellite technology, we started measuring the amount of biota on Earth. And what the satellite data here shows is that the planet has become steadily greener over the last 20 years. And one reason for that is the extra CO2 that's been put into the atmosphere. It has promoted plant growth. Another reason for the planet becoming greener has been the warmth that we've seen for much of the last half century. And the warmth also promotes plant growth. It allows the tree line to go further north. It's beneficial for greenery.
We exhale CO2, don't we?
Yes, we do.
And in effect, we're in a carbon biosphere. In your book, it talked about how the ocean has 50 times more CO2 than the atmosphere. So why is the EPA demonizing carbon?
Well, this is perhaps the only tool that the U.S. administration has to control CO2. I believe that a cap and trade bill can no longer pass because the science has now gone overwhelmingly to establishing that there is no credible risk of a catastrophe that comes of CO2. So there isn't going to be legislation. So the U.S. administration, which wants to do something about greenhouse gases, will have to use the EPA to do it, and that's the only tool it likely will have, so that's the only tool it's going to be using.
Can we trust the EPA today?
This is such a politicized area that I would say no. I certainly would not trust it.
Professor Tom Siegelstad talked about CO2, and he talked about how the models related to CO2, that there's a missing 3 gigatons of carbon not explained by the model. Can you explain this?
It's actually quite a convoluted explanation, but basically the models can't account for a huge amount of CO2, and there are various theories about where it could possibly be. And Siegelstad has the answer. He said it's not missing. It's simply in the ocean. There's always been a balance between the CO2 in the ocean and the CO2 in the atmosphere. It's been regulated naturally since time immemorial, and that explains it.
Dr. Sammy Solansky, I looked up on Wikipedia. He was one of the people that you interviewed at the Max Planck Institute for Solar Systems Research in Germany. Can you say something about him? And then I want to talk to you about what I found on Wikipedia.
Well, he's actually interesting in several ways. He, when I interviewed scientists, many of them were, at least especially at the beginning of my of writing my newspaper columns, which ultimately became my book, many scientists were reluctant to be interviewed initially, and many refused to be interviewed. Others didn't want me to even use their published information in my book. And
that ought to tell you something right there. Why a climate of fear like this? There shouldn't be. There should be excitement to share and synthesize and cross-pollinate information and findings, correct?
There should be, but they also know that that their funding depends on having the right results and the right interpretation from their data, the acceptable interpretation from their data. Even in some cases, scientists are willing to risk the scorn of others, but they find that their colleagues in their university departments aren't aren't happy with that because they fear that the entire university could lose its funding, the entire university department could lose its funding, not just the scientist that decides to go rogue. So there are a lot of pressures on scientists. In some cases the scientists have told me what their reasons are, and others of course they won't tell me. But that's something that I have remarked, that a lot of scientists do not want to be public.
Dr. Solanke from Germany said something was written in Wikipedia regarding your interview with him that he was misquoted. Do you agree with that, or is that just somebody going on Wikipedia writing whatever they want to write to discount your interview with him?
Well, it's interesting because Solanke told me that. And he said, where have I ever said this? And I gave him about six citations for where he had said it. And I think he was quiet after that. I don't know if he didn't realize how often he had made certain assertions, or if there was some kind of a bravado. But it's indisputable that he made the claims he made. He just wasn't happy with them being put in, being repeated by me, because it didn't serve the interests of his institute.
Then I would probably respond to that section on Wikipedia. I used to think Wikipedia was a great thing, and now with everybody being able to go in, well, not now, that's how it started. Everybody can go in and change everything, so you can smear, discredit, lie, distort, and people will think that what they're reading, because it's Wikipedia, is all facts, and it's not. When I read this little piece that he was misquoted, I thought, how could someone do an interview with somebody or put somebody in a book that goes all over the world, particularly on something this serious, and misquote him? It didn't make sense to me. So I'm glad you addressed it. Dr. Shaviv from Israel, talk a little bit about him.
Well, he co-authored a study that concluded that most of the global warming comes from natural causes. It comes from the cosmic rays. He came under heavy criticism, as did his co-author.
What is going to happen now with regard to your book being out? Are you doing speaking engagements, traveling to talk about this book? What is the next step for you?
Well, a paperback edition of The Deniers is just coming out now. It might be out this week, for all I know. And yes, I do some traveling, and I do talk to members of the press, such as you, who are interested. And from my perspective, the debate is nearing its end. The majority of the public in most of the Western countries now have radically changed their views. They're very skeptical of the notion that global warming represents anything dangerous. I think we should be able to wrap this up fairly soon.
Talk about your work with Energy Probe. What are you doing with nuclear power, if you wouldn't mind just sharing a few minutes about that?
Well, we're critics of nuclear power. We've been critics of nuclear power since the 1970s, mainly on economic grounds. Nuclear power has never been economic anywhere in the world. No nuclear reactor has been built without government backstops. There's no reason really for this technology to be promoted, but it's being promoted out of a kind of ideological commitment that so many people have to nuclear power. It's actually a very inflexible technology. I view it as an immature technology. Nuclear power has to run 24/7. It's in the nature of the of the technology. Otherwise, its operations can be dangerous. But so because it has to run 24/7, it doesn't have the flexibility that other forms of generating electricity have. So it will be, because it's running flat out all the time, a plant will provide more than enough energy to meet needs at say 3 o'clock in the morning when people are asleep, and too little energy when people need it at say six o'clock in the evening. You can't ramp up nuclear reactors to give you extra power when you need it. You can't ramp it down when society goes to sleep. So the result is that the few jurisdictions that have tried to rely on nuclear power have gotten into trouble. The best example of this is France, which generates close to 80% of its electricity from nuclear power. What happens is, during most of the day, it's producing much more than it needs. So it has to export its surplus to neighboring countries. But because power at 3 o'clock doesn't have much value, it exports its electricity at a loss to its neighbors. It's lucky it has neighbors that are larger than it who can absorb the surplus electricity, but it's exporting that electricity at a loss. Meanwhile, at peak periods, it's short of electricity because it can't ramp up its nuclear plants. So at peak periods, when electricity is very expensive, it has to import electricity from its neighbors. So France brings in a lot of electricity, most of it from Germany. And that is ruinously expensive. So it's importing electricity at high cost. It's exporting it at low cost. It's losing a lot of money in the process. It became so disastrous for the for France that the head of the French power utility, Electricité de France, called the financial system situation catastrophic. France is now bringing back its old oil fire generating stations that were built in the 1960s to meet its peak requirements, because it found it just couldn't go on on this nuclear path.
What do you think we should be doing for transportation?
My preferred remedy is to start tolling all the roads, to toll roads based on the demand for those roads. So the tolling should be higher at peak periods and lower at off-peak periods. And that way the road system would be used much more intelligently. I think we would eliminate all traffic jams if we had proper pricing systems in place. The system is called congestion pricing. A few European cities have started it, and Europe plans to go to the system. It has proven to be very popular. You might think that tolling would be unpopular, but in practice it became popular. A good example is what happened in Stockholm. Before the tolling experiment started, the public was against it. The polling that took place showed that the public didn't want it. But a 6-month trial period was put in place, and the public was given a chance to try it out. And then a referendum was held after it. Well, as soon as the trial period started, Stockholm residents saw that their travel times decreased. Life became easier for them. They found it wasn't difficult to rearrange their schedules to avoid the peak pricing. Then the experiment ended after 6 months. The day after it ended, the traffic congestion came back, and people started grumbling about the fact that they no longer had their system. the referendum took place, and it passed. The majority of Stockholm residents decided they would rather pay for the service that they get and get a good service rather than have a free service that led to frustration. London was the first city to try a tolling system. It became the issue on which a mayoralty candidate campaigned. He said, "Elect me mayor, and I will bring in this tolling system." To everyone's surprise, he was elected. The tolling system was brought in, and it was popular. He then ran for re-election on that scheme. It ended up becoming unpopular in London because it became used for all kinds of politically correct measures, including global warming. So all kinds of taxes were heaped on. But when the tolling was used in a way that was simply meant as an economic instrument to charge more at peak periods, to charge less at off-peak periods.
I listened to you very carefully, and I could see how that could work. But doesn't that then translate as penalizing the people that have 9-to-5 jobs because they're getting to work early in the morning? I mean, I'm an entrepreneur, and I've been on a mission for 25 years, so I don't have to deal with what 95% or 99% of the people have to deal with every day, having to be on the road and at a place at 8 or 9. And therefore, the peak hours of traffic congestion are for the average person who has to be at a work location by 8 or 9, right? And then has an hour for lunch between 12 and 1 or 1 and 2, and then is going to go home sometime between 5 and 7. Most employers are not going to shift their minds about that. So how do you see that supporting the average person?
When people decide where they're going to work and where they're going to live, they usually take their transportation costs into account.
Right.
Often people decide, I can get a bigger house further out. It means I have to travel an extra half hour or an extra hour, but it's worth it to me. So people make that kind of calculation. They're always trading off distance, size of house, with convenience and cost. And usually when they figure out the cost of living further out, they will look at, say, their gasoline costs and maybe the wear and tear on their car, but they'll trade that off against saving a lot of money, perhaps, on the capital purchase of their house. Well, if there was a more realistic calculation that occurred, if they had to account not only for the cost of using their car and their gasoline, but the cost of the road, which right now people don't see directly. Often they don't pay at all for the roads that they use. If they had to pay for the cost of their roads, they would start making a different calculation. And what we would see is people would start living closer to their work or closer to their school, and their travel times would come down, and therefore their commuting costs would go down. So we would see people's living patterns change naturally as they responded to the pricing signals.
Maybe I'm not sure. I can see it on a conceptual level, but in the practicality, there are so many people I know that live an hour or an hour and a half that drive in to, let's say, Burbank or Los Angeles to do their day job, and they'll do that, but if they had to live close to where they were working, they would pay double the rent they're paying now. And I think when you get down to the brass tacks of that translation, I'm not sure it would equate exactly the way that you're saying, but I think it's an interesting prospect to consider tolls. I just don't know how the people that have traditional day jobs wouldn't be penalized in the process.
In the past, cities were residential areas. We still have in our cities very nice residential areas, but most of them have been degraded over time. They were really degraded since the 1930s. The Depression prevented reinvestment in nice areas, and then the wartime economy made it difficult, and then public attitudes changed largely because road systems were subsidized, and the interstates came in, and public dollars transformed the traditional lifestyle that Americans had. I think by withdrawing the subsidized road systems that were brought in place mostly after World War II, we would revert to the kinds of living patterns that historically we had, which were living much closer to home, shorter travel distances. I think there would be more urban communities, fewer suburban communities. The communities would tend to be denser, more compact, more services within communities. So I think living patterns would change, but they would change not to something terribly unfamiliar. They would change to what they were like, say, in the 1920s.
Would you be interested in building a new eco-city or developing some ecosystem and an eco-city somewhere around the world?
No, I'm not. I'm not a utopian that way.
What do you do at Urban Renaissance?
It's a division of the same foundation of Energy Probe Research Foundation, and it's concerned with with precisely the kind of issue I just described with road tolling, with the living patterns that that people have. What we have done over the last few decades is heavily subsidized rural development and suburban development, and at the expense of urban development. And the effect of it has been to decrease densities in cities so they are less city-like, and to increase densities on the outskirts so that they're less rural. And the effect of that is to create a kind of a mush where we've lost our wilderness areas, we've lost our rural areas, and we've also lost our urban areas. So I'd like to see a restoration of the balance, and I don't want to impose that balance. My utopia is simply letting people do what they naturally would do if they weren't being pushed and prodded this way or that by government incentives of one kind or another.
Do you have any concern about the radiation from microwave radiation stations or the level of radiation that's coming in from outer space and how that may affect climate?
Well, that has always affected climate. A lot of the solar scientists have theories about how radiation affects climate, but this isn't something we're about to change. You know, the sun is going to keep shining for a few billion more years, and I don't see any way of dealing with that.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us as we end this discussion?
One point that people often don't appreciate is that our attempts to comply with Kyoto not only have economic costs, they have environmental costs. In fact, Kyoto has become the single biggest destroyer of the global environment. My environmental group works with citizens groups in the third world, works with them at the grassroots level, and many of them are up in arms over what Kyoto has done to them. When we try to cut back on carbon emissions here, often through mechanisms such as carbon credits, you know, we might purchase a carbon offset. Well, the other half of that transaction is the purchase of a carbon sink, typically somewhere in the third world. Typically, it's something like a eucalyptus plantation. Eucalyptus is a fast-growing tree. It's very good at taking carbon out of the air. Well, to get the land to plant that eucalyptus plantation, farmers are often driven off their land in the third world, and then the carbon credits are used to finance a eucalyptus plantation, or an old-growth forest might be taken down and replaced with a eucalyptus plantation. Carbon credits are also financing hydro dams throughout the third world. You know, many hundreds of hydro dams, and hydro dams stopped being economic many decades ago. All the good hydro sites were taken up, say 40, 50, 60 years ago, and the ones that remain aren't economic to develop. Well, now with carbon credits from the West, those hydro dams are being developed. And when you build a hydro dam, you're often taking out a river valley. Often that's the most arable land in the country. So we're losing arable farmland. We're losing species because these uneconomic dams are being built. We're often relocating a lot of people, so they're losing their livelihoods because we're building these economic dams. So Kyoto has devastating environmental consequences. It's not just an economic calculus that we have to look at.
Wasn't a major hydro dam put in China that displaced a few million people?
That's right. The Three Gorges Dam, the biggest dam ever ever built, and in fact, the Three Gorges Dam has been opposing it. Has been a lot of the work of my foundation's Probe International division. It's been the chief organization opposing this dam since 1990.
What happened to all those people?
Well, they were driven off their land. They were typically promised compensation. They were told they would have a cash settlement and equal land elsewhere. Often, when they showed up at the government department to collect their compensation for their land, they were told, "Oh, I see you've already received your compensation." So, what happened was corrupt officials would sign in for them, take their money. So as a result, there's been all kinds of riots when people were denied their compensation. Out of desperation, many have resorted to violence. Others that didn't, when they went to the new lands, they found that instead of the lowlands that they were used to, say, and fertile land by the river, they were given land high up that wasn't arable, and it's not surprising that the land which wasn't settled wouldn't be desirable land. That's why it hasn't been settled. But that's what the government would give them as compensation. So it created enormous upset, and several million people were moved. Cities were inundated. Species were affected. Archaeological treasures were inundated. Enormous cost, the cost to navigation as well. To finance the hydro dam, the Three Gorges Dam, a national tax was imposed on electricity users throughout China, because although the dam was promised to come in at a low cost, it was expensive in the end, and so expensive that no one wanted to buy power from the Three Gorges Dam. They wanted to buy power from other electricity sources. So the government forbade that, forced everyone to take power from the dam and to finance the dam. They imposed this tax on users across the country, regardless of whether they were actually using power from the dam.
Lawrence, are you familiar with the energy source called helium-3?
No, I'm not.
It's the source of energy that Harrison Schmitt wrote his book Return to the Moon about. That's very prevalent, this energy source called helium-3. He's very interested in making sure we have available here. That's supposed to be phenomenal. I'll find out on Thursday. Want to go to the moon for this next electric opportunity?
Well, I don't view there being any energy crisis. I think there is enormous amounts of fuel of all varieties. The only question is the cost of the energy, whether financial cost or environmental cost, and that will vary from region to region. But I don't see there being any energy shortage of any kind materializing in centuries.
Do you have any concern about our grid, both in Canada and the United States?
Well, the grid isn't as reliable as it should be. The UK grid became very reliable after it was privatized in 1989-1990. Before then, it had been derelict, lots of outages. After privatization, there was a very good regulatory regime was brought in into the UK, where the private grid company would have to pay if it inconvenienced customers by having power outages. And the grid became very good at avoiding discomforting its customers. It's a very good model for all of us.
What is this big explosion about Bloom Energy? What is it? It just came out. It was on Google. I guess Google's on the board, or Google's part of this new Bloom Energy. What is it?
Well, there's a lot of hype about it. It's the latest incarnation of the fuel cell, which is a gizmo. It's a battery-like gizmo that can be fueled by natural gas. The Bloom cell would be fueled by natural gas. And the idea is that you don't need to have a grid, an electricity grid. You can just have one of these little fuel cells, which are, say, the size of a small fridge for a house, or a large fridge or several fridges for a company. And you can dispense with the power lines coming into your house. You would instead run your fuel cell off natural gas, or in some areas you might run it off a different biogas.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's mostly hype, but ultimately there are lots of competing fuel cells out there. I think they all have their place. The problem with the Bloom Box, as well as the problem with energy technologies generally, is that the government plays such a large role in picking winners and losers that it distorts. Distorts the economy for all these energy technologies. So the fuel cell, the Bloom Box, is getting government subsidies, and the idea behind it is that it could eliminate the electricity grid. Meanwhile, governments are pouring billions of dollars into next generation electricity grids. So the two are unlikely to coexist, at least as presently imagined. So there's a disconnect caused by competing government policies, and in my view, the only way to sensibly sort it all out is for government to abandon the energy business entirely and let the Bloom Energy and all the other technologies find their own place in the energy marketplace.
Do you think that you and I are going to be alive to be forced to use carbon measuring devices and to have them in our homes and cars?
No, I think all that's going to disappear pretty soon. I think the whole carbon dioxide scare will be disappearing.
Fabulous. That's fabulous, because that's really scary, because that means you have to have carbon measuring devices in the ocean. You have to have carbon measuring devices on every living thing if you really want to calculate it all, don't you?
Yeah, well, it's not a realistic. It's another one of these utopian schemes. I don't think it will go anywhere.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been learning from Lawrence Solomon, the author of The Deniers, the world-renowned scientist who stood up against global warming hysteria, political persecution, and fraud, and those who are too fearful to do so, and the executive director of Energy Probe. Lawrence, thank you so much for your time today, and we hope that you'll join us again.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.